Good morning. I'm Ed Whalen, President of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I'm pleased to welcome you to this dialogue on the topic of judicial independence. Before we start, let me remind you that lunch will follow immediately after this. We're going to stop sharply at noon and go straight to lunch without a break. Judicial independence seems to be one of those concepts that virtually everyone favors, but to which different people assign very different meanings. The very phrase judicial independence invites the question, independence from what? But that question seems curiously neglected. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor has made defense of judicial independence a project of her post-judicial career. 2 years ago, in a Wall Street Journal op-ed entitled The Threat to Judicial Independence, she declared that the breadth and intensity of rage currently being leveled at the judiciary may be unmatched in American history. In immediate support of this dramatic proposition, Justice O'Connor presented these assertions. These are all quotes. The ubiquitous activist judges who legislate from the bench have become central villains on today's domestic political landscape. Elected officials routinely score cheap points by railing against the elitist judges. Several Jeremiads are published every year warning of the dangers of judicial supremacy and judicial tyranny. And using judges as punching bags presents a grave threat to the independent judiciary. Now, to be sure, Justice O'Connor assured her readers that an independent judiciary does not mean that it's somehow improper to criticize judicial decisions, and that what matters is, quote, making sure that criticism does not cross over into intimidation. But her ability to distinguish between criticism and intimidation is highly suspect when she evidently finds intimidating such phrases as activist judges, legislate from the bench, and judicial supremacy. In the interest of full disclosure, I'll volunteer that in my Bench Memos blog on National Review Online and in my other writings, I regularly engage in vigorous criticism of unsound judicial rulings and of judges who don't understand the proper limits of the judicial role. So I won't pretend to be neutral on Justice O'Connor's expansive conception of judicial independence. And I'm sorry, but not surprised, that she has applied to the topic of judicial independence the same level of analytical rigor that, alas, marked her judicial career. Now, my role today is to moderate, or perhaps to aggravate, a discussion between our two distinguished guests, both of whom, as it happens, hail from the state of Alabama. I'll introduce them very briefly. Judge William H. Pryor, Jr. has served with distinction on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit since 2004. From 1997 to 2004, Judge Pryor was Attorney General of the state of Alabama. Among his publications is a 2007 Virginia Law Review article titled, Not So Serious Threats to Judicial Independence. H. Thomas Wells, Jr., to my right, is serving a one-year term as President of the American Bar Association. For the last decade or so, the ABA has had a standing committee on judicial independence, which, among other things, as it puts it, provides resources to enable lawyers and the public to respond in a timely fashion to unfair and unjust criticism of judges. Mr. Wells is a partner and founding member of the law firm of Maynard, Cooper, and Gale in Birmingham, Alabama. Does the concept of judicial independence derive from and reflect separation of powers principles? And do the real threats to judicial independence come from governmental actors, including judges, who fail to respect these principles? Or, as Justice O'Connor evidently believes, does judicial independence require that citizens be especially delicate and deferential in expressing their criticisms of judges and judicial rulings? Is there some middle ground position? Are lawyers who embrace expansive notions of judicial independence, like Justice O'Connor's, really just trying to ingratiate themselves with judges in order to advance their own professional ambitions? Or worse, to provide camouflage for activist judges who advance the ideological agendas the lawyers favor? Should we instead be concerned about the threats that judicial supremacy poses to our system of representative government? I hope that today's discussion will shed light on what judicial independence properly understood is and on what are and are not genuine threats to judicial independence. Judge Pryor.
Good morning. Thank you, Ed, for that introduction. I think it's fitting that there are two speakers for this dialogue who hail from the great state of Alabama. After all, it is November. It's the month of the great end of college football season. And the mighty Crimson Tide, All Is Right in the World, is ranked number one and undefeated. Roll Tide. Talk of judicial independence, as Ed mentioned, all the rage. In recent years, leaders of the bench and bar have derided what they describe as unprecedented assaults on the independence of the judiciary. The most prominent leader of this chorus has been, as Ed mentioned, a distinguished American and public servant, retired Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. At a meeting of the American Law Institute, Justice O'Connor thanked the Institute for its defense of judicial independence, which she described as under the most serious attack in her lifetime. And as he read a moment ago in her op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Justice O'Connor stated that the breadth and intensity of rage currently being leveled at the judiciary is perhaps unmatched in American history. But she has not been alone. Michael Greco, when he was the president recently of the American Bar Association, addressed the House of Delegates and said, ironically, while American lawyers and the American Bar Association are helping to build independent judicial systems in emerging democracies around the world, our own courts are under unprecedented attack. Michael Traynor, in a letter to the membership of the American Law Institute, of which he served as president, wrote, judicial independence is especially important today because the judiciary and the rule of law are under relentless and severe attacks from various quarters. Now, Chief Justice Roberts even got into the act a couple of years ago as he urged Congress to provide judges an increase in salaries and described the current level of pay as a threat to judicial independence. Now, I respectfully disagree with the conventional wisdom of the bench and bar. I submit that the independence of the judiciary today is as secure as ever. The current criticisms of the judiciary are relatively mild and, on balance, a benefit to the judiciary. Now, I will say I'm sympathetic to a call for an increase in pay. My spouse is a certified public accountant and frequently reminds me of the opportunity cost of public service. But to say that our current level of pay is a threat to our independence, I think, is an exaggeration. As a judge whose nomination and confirmation generated controversy, even a filibuster, there was even litigation about my earlier recess appointment, I believe that the appointment process, on balance, is beneficial to the judiciary. I do not mean to suggest that judicial independence is unimportant. It is indispensable to the rule of law. Thomas Paine explained in Common Sense, in absolute governments, the king is law, but in America, the law is king. Judicial independence is now and has always been the primary reason that in America the law is king. But if we look at a brief review of the history of our judiciary, and particularly the Supreme Court of the United States, it would suggest that there is a tested method for defending our independence, and that is to respect the limits of our authority. To that end, I want to talk briefly about three things. First, I want to talk about the original understanding of judicial independence. Second, I want to address three moments in American history when the independence of the judiciary was challenged and the lesson to be learned from that history. And then I want to explain briefly why I think the contemporary challenges to the judiciary are not serious threats to independence. Americans recognized the need for judicial independence from the beginning of our nation. Two of the grievances against King George listed in the Declaration of Independence involved the absence of judicial independence in colonial America. The Declaration charged that the king had obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing the judiciary powers and had made judges dependent on his will alone, both for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries. And the framers widely agreed that we needed an independent judiciary at the Constitutional Convention. They first vested the entire judicial power in a federal judiciary. Second, they provided that judges would have life tenure, or as the Constitution puts it, tenure during good behavior. And they provided that the compensation of judges shall not be diminished during their continuation in office. The framers believed in judicial independence, but not in the literal sense of the word independent. They expected the judiciary to be accountable to the people. Judges would be appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Judges would be subject to impeachment. Judges would be bound by oath or affirmation to support the Constitution and laws of the United States. Judicial independence, as originally understood and is understood today, refers to two kinds of independence. One strong, the other weak. The first is decisional independence. That is, the ability of an individual judge to decide each case fairly and impartially based on the facts and law. The second is institutional independence. That is, the ability of the judiciary as a separate branch to protect its institutional integrity. The structure of the Constitution provides strong protections for the decisional independence of the judiciary, but weak protections for its institutional independence. We have what scholars have described as independent judges and a dependent judiciary. This design was explained during the ratification debates by the most eloquent defender of judicial independence, the original Wall Street lawyer, Alexander Hamilton. In Federalist 78, he explicated the tie between strong decisional independence and judicial review. He described life tenure as the foremost guarantee of decisional independence and protection from cuts in pay as a close second. When the Anti-Federalists charged that the judiciary would be too independent, Hamilton responded that the judiciary would be institutionally weak, the least dangerous branch, because it has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of society. But what about Federalist 81, where Hamilton responded about the ultimate check of judicial abuse? He also wrote that Americans could rest assured that the judiciary would not abuse its power because Congress retained the check of impeachment. Now, after this auspicious beginning, there have been at least three periods of serious challenges to the independence of the judiciary, two in the 19th century, one in the 20th. The first came during the advent of the administration of Thomas Jefferson. The second came during Reconstruction. The third came during the New Deal. Each period of challenge was marked with restraint by the judiciary, followed by increased respect for its independence. When Thomas Jefferson and his political party wrested control of both the presidency and Congress, the losing Federalists during their lame duck session passed the Judiciary Act of 1801, which created new judgeships. In the final weeks of the administration, President Adams nominated and the Senate confirmed Federalists to fill the new offices, and in the final hours, Adams signed the commissions for the new officers, the so-called midnight judges. Some of the commissions, that including that of William Marbury, were not delivered before Adams' term expired, and the new president refused to honor the appointments. When the Jeffersonian Republicans came to power, they proceeded to undo the work of the Federalists. They repealed the Judiciary Act, abolished the new judgeships, canceled the June and December terms of the Supreme Court, and as every law student learns, William Marbury then sued Jefferson's Secretary of State, James Madison, by filing a petition for writ of mandamus in the Supreme Court. Most scholars believe that the Jefferson administration would not have obeyed in order to deliver that commission. The Supreme Court responded to this controversy with its most celebrated decision in American history, Marbury versus Madison. And that decision was a model of restraint that would help set the stage for the judiciary to weather a serious challenge from the Jeffersonians. Rather than order the delivery of the commission, the court dismissed it. Before reaching its decision, the court explained that it would not review any political judgment of the executive. The court ruled that the purported grant of original jurisdiction for the court to issue the writ was unconstitutional because Article III defined and limited the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. The court acted with restraint. Now, not long afterwards, of course, there was an attempt by the Jeffersonian Republicans. The House voted to impeach Justice Samuel Chase, but he was acquitted by the Senate. And I don't want to say that there was a cause and effect, but I would propose that perhaps if the court had reacted differently in Marbury versus Madison and worsened branch relations, perhaps the Chase trial would not have turned out so well. The second challenge came, of course, during Reconstruction. The Reconstruction Congress did not look kindly on the federal judiciary because of the Dred Scott decision. Particularly, they did not look kindly on the Supreme Court. And we all know about the case of Ex Parte McCardle, when a newspaper editor from Vicksburg, Mississippi, was jailed awaiting trial by a military tribunal on charges of inciting insurrection and impeding Reconstruction. He filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus that eventually found its way to the Supreme Court. Everyone expected the Supreme Court to declare the Reconstruction Acts unconstitutional, but the court instead awaited the judgment of Congress to repeal its appellate jurisdiction and dismiss the case. In the years following, Congress responded by enlarging the jurisdiction of the federal courts, reducing circuit riding responsibilities of Supreme Court justices. The restraint of the court was reciprocated with, and I'm not saying this was cause and effect, but had the court acted without restraint, perhaps the federal judiciary would not have done as well as it did in the later years. And, of course, we all know then from the New Deal period about President Roosevelt's court packing proposal. And we know, too, that near that time, the Supreme Court changed its perspective of economic and social legislation coming from Congress. Justice Roberts' vote, which was called the switch in time that saved nine, which he had agreed to do in conference before Roosevelt ever unveiled his court packing legislation, ultimately diffused a controversy, and the independence of the federal judiciary remains secure. Now, I think one lesson from this history is that the judiciary serves as its best defender of its independence by acting with restraint. But if you look at these moments in history and you contrast them with what are regarded as the contemporary threats to judicial independence, whether it's public criticisms of the judiciary or legislation to curb judicial power or the politics of appointment and particularly the confirmation process, I think they all pale in comparison. Criticisms of the judiciary, read dissenting opinions of Supreme Court justices. They're far harsher than virtually anything that is said in the political arena. I mean, we have a few law professors here. My gosh, if we end criticism of the judiciary, what are all these law professors going to do? They already have too much free time, one might argue. And look, judges and law professors need each other. How else are we to expect anyone to read what each other writes? What about legislation to curb the judiciary? We may hear from my friend from Birmingham that, you know, there was this terrible proposal in South Dakota that sponsored by a group called Jail for Judges. What happened to that proposal? It was defeated by 89.21% of the voters of South Dakota. They got nowhere. It looks like judicial independence is still safe in South Dakota. And then there's the confirmation process. Yes, it's gotten heated. It's gotten political. There's no question about that. But I've had two different lives. I've had a political life before I had the privilege of service in my current judicial life. Trust me, if given the choice between having to endure what senators and the president have to endure, speaking on the stump, shaking the hands, riding the rubber chicken circuit, filming the advertisements, raising the funds, I'll take answering the questions in the confirmation process every single day. There's a lot that we should expect for those who are going to serve the public. There's a lot at stake. But at the end of the day, I would say that if you want to look for who should be the best guardians of judicial independence, look in the mirror. It is not unfair for judges to ask sometimes whether some criticisms of our work are unfair. Ultimately, our independence depends on the persuasiveness of our own work and our own opinions. So we are the best and first guardians of judicial independence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. First, let me begin with two very clear areas that my friend Bill Pryor and I agree on. Number one, it's always good to have a conversation with someone else who doesn't have an accent. And second, things are right in the world when the Crimson Tide is number one in November. In my year leading up to becoming president of the American Bar Association, a post I assumed in August just a few months ago, I spent a good bit of time traveling and talking to bar associations, bar leaders, judges, and others across the country. Indeed, I think I'm correct that I've been on the road so far this calendar year approximately 200 days. I can't imagine what the presidential candidates can think about their travel schedule, given the wear and tear it has given on my body. But in that, I was hearing from different places, from different bar associations, from different lawyers, and from different judges, what at first seemed to me to be sort of dissonant comments, until I had a chance to go back and reflect on what they were saying. And as I had a chance to reflect, it all sort of coalesced in my mind that what they were really talking about in their particular location, in their particular jurisdiction, in their particular court, were in one way or another threats to judicial independence. Let me enumerate what I see as some of the threats to judicial independence. I am not going to limit my remarks to the federal system, obviously, because I've been talking to state bar associations, local bar associations, state court judges, as well as federal court judges. So I'm going to talk in a broader sense than simply the federal system. As I see it, first and foremost, as the threat to judicial independence is the escalating politicization of the selection process, particularly but not exclusively in state high courts. I think, unfortunately, we are now seeing the predicted bad effects in state judicial races of the Supreme Court's decision in Republican Party of Minnesota versus White. I would point you to two examples. One, there is now a pending judicial disciplinary proceeding in Wisconsin entitled In Re Judicial Disciplinary Proceedings versus Honorable Michael Gabelman. Mr. Gabelman was running to unseat a sitting justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and in doing so ran what is reported to be a patently false ad, that while as a public defender, the sitting justice had gotten an accused off on a, quote, loophole or technicality, allowing this person to go off and commit more crimes. Mr. Gabelman, as you can tell by the style, since he is now the Honorable Michael Gabelman, despite the fact that he ran a reportedly patently false ad, is now the subject of judicial disciplinary proceedings, to which he is responding, guess what, Republican Party of Minnesota versus White. I have the First Amendment right to say and do almost anything in a judicial election. Let me give you a second example. This is from my own home state of Alabama. We had a rather nasty race for the open seat of Justice Harold C., who was on our panel yesterday, where we had two candidates who, between the two of them, spent $3.8 million. I'm glad Justice C. Realizes now his seat was worth so much. But in addition to the $3.8 million that the candidates spent, there was an interest group in Virginia that was running what are called push polls. They spent over $1 million in advertising. But in addition, they were doing these push polls, and in doing the push polls, they were making false statements about supposed rankings of the candidates by the Alabama State Bar. These were patently false, to the point that the president of the Alabama State Bar, Mark White, has referred the matter to the state attorney general for investigation of these false ads. I submit to you that the costly and unseemly elections that we are seeing causes a perception, at least in the public, of influence of contributions on decisions. And I see that as a direct threat to the decisional independence of our judiciary. We've also talked a bit about the Caperton versus Massey Coal Company case that was, I believe, discussed a bit yesterday. For those of you who weren't here, this is a case where the Supreme Court just granted certiorari in a situation where a coal company sued the president of another coal company in West Virginia. I believe, as I recall, it was a tortious interference with business relations case and received a multi-million dollar verdict. In the interim, the judgment debtor donated $3 million to the campaign of a lawyer who was running for the West Virginia Supreme Court, who got elected, who then heard the case and decided not to recuse himself and cast the deciding vote, the one vote majority, to reverse the judgment against the multi-million dollar judgment against the judgment debtor. I submit to you again, this is a situation, and I'm familiar with the facts of this case because the American Bar Association, in part at the request of Ted Olson, who was representing the appellant in that case, filed an amicus brief at the petition for certiorari stage, something that we rarely do. But we perceive this to be enough of a judicial independence issue, and the request actually came up through our Standing Committee on Judicial Independence that we decided to file at the petition stage. Now that the petition has been granted, we will, of course, be filing at the merit stage. Is the sort of common sense that this perception that contributions might influence decisions borne out when you actually poll people? I suggest to you that it does. The polls in the past several years have shown that while 78% of the people believe that courts should be free of political and public pressure, still 72% of the people polled are concerned that money, contributions, compromise judicial impartiality. 76% believes that the money contributed in judicial elections influences decisions in judicial elections. And a surprising over half of those responded believed that elected courts were, quote, controlled by special interests. That, my friends, is a threat to the decisional independence of those courts. As my friend Bill Pryor said, the courts don't control either the purse or the sword, and so public perception of the courts is an important part of judicial independence. Now, obviously, in judicial selection, whatever method you choose, whether it be the appointment process in the federal and some state systems or the elective process, in that area is probably where the tension between judicial independence and judicial accountability is probably the greatest. And that, I submit to you, is why we spend so much time, and all of us have spent a good bit of time at this meeting, talking about judicial selection and judicial terms. Politics will never be removed from judicial selection. That's a pipe dream. We can't do it. There are, however, ways that we can control it. I don't know how many of you are golfers. I happen to be one. But I sort of liken the process to what I've said about my sand wedge. lurking inside every sand wedge is a 2-iron trying to get out. I think it's the same way with judicial selection. Politics are inherent in the process. There is nothing wrong with that. However, like a boiling pot that you have a lid on, at some point the lid blows off. And the question becomes, can you simply turn down the temperature enough that you don't blow the lid off? I submit that we are in a situation now, particularly in state court elective politics, where the lid has blown off, or that 2-iron trying to get out of my sand wedge has reappeared. Now, I mentioned that this is not necessarily, I think, limited to the state selection system. Although clearly less of a threat, the federal selection and confirmation process, in my view, has still become recently overly politicized. At times, rancor and sometimes bitterly partisan confirmation battles have taken place. Interestingly, at the presentation yesterday, Professor Bill Kelly mentioned one way that he had seen from his standpoint of working in the White House that perhaps there might be a better mousetrap. It's interesting because the model that he cited was the commission model used by the two Democratic senators in California to recommend Republican nominees to the Bush White House. Indeed, that is exactly the model that the American Bar Association proposes and adopted at our meeting in New York in August, that the senators put together bipartisan citizens' commissions to recommend, not to dictate, but to recommend names to the senators who could then recommend names to the White House, not trying to take away either nomination or confirmation. Obviously, you can't do that. Those are constitutional. But in the 8 states that that process is being used in, quite frankly, the lid has generally been kept on that boiling pot of politics. Let me mention to you some other threats that I have seen in traveling across the country. Judge Pryor mentioned the jail for judges in South Dakota. I am going to mention that. This was a threat to judicial independence directly. It would have removed judicial immunity, which I believe we all can agree is an inherent part of judicial independence, that judges are immune from civil liability or criminal liability for their decisional actions. The Jail for Judges initiative, when first polled, was polling well in excess of 70% yes. It was only by a remarkable combination of the organized bar, the South Dakota Bar Association, the business community, that ballot initiative was ultimately defeated. That, however, is not the only ballot initiative that has been in play in the past few years. There have been one ballot initiative and one attempt to put a ballot initiative on the ballot in Colorado. This was another out-of-state funded ballot initiative that would have so severely term-limited Colorado judges that they could never vest in the state retirement system. It was narrowly defeated the first time it came up, and then last year I was meeting with the Colorado Bar, and they were quite afraid that it was going to come up again. In fact, the petitions were being circulated. Luckily, that did not get sufficient names on the petitions to make it to the ballot, but it was a concern of the Colorado Bar and the judges in Colorado that it would be a threat to judicial independence. I'm going to mention just a couple of others that I've seen and I've heard from bar associations. One, of course, is unjust criticism. I'm not talking about just any criticism. I'm talking about unjust criticism. of judges and judicial opinions. There is a line there. All of us can probably draw it at some point, but I think there are some points along that continuum on which we can all agree. When someone in Congress says, "I disagree with the decision of the 11th Circuit and Judge Pryor, I think we ought to impeach the entire panel because of that decision," that's a threat to judicial independence. We shouldn't be impeaching judges simply because a person in Congress decides they don't like the opinion. Fortunately for us, this year in the presidential elections, the candidates did not make the courts a political football, and I commend both campaigns for doing that. At the American Bar Association, we were prepared in case that happened. We believe preparation is better than reaction. We were also prepared if there were election contests. Fortunately, we also didn't have to deal with that eventuality. There are others that have been mentioned: jurisdiction stripping, funding. Indeed, at the state court level, with probably only two exceptions, lack of funding is a threat to judicial independence. It is so much so that the American Bar Association is teaming with the National Center for State Courts to have a fair and independent court summit in May, one of the centerpieces of which will be to have delegations led by the Chief Justice of, we hope, at least 25 states. I think we've got 18 committed so far, a representative of the executive branch and a representative of the legislature to talk about the importance of adequate funding for the third branch of government. Here we're clearly talking about not decisional independence, but institutional independence of the judiciary. And quite frankly, I couldn't talk about funding without talking about salaries, particularly at the federal level, although quite frankly, there are several state courts, as I'm sure you know, that link the state court salaries to the federal salaries. There are a certain percentage of the federal salaries. As Judge Pryor indicated, Chief Justice Roberts has called this a threat to judicial independence. And indeed, the situation as we stand today is, unless Congress acts in this lame duck session, Congress will get a cost of living adjustment, but federal judges will not. That, I submit, is unconscionable. And I also submit that if one of the important parts of judicial independence, particularly at the federal level, is no diminution in pay, it's a little hard to see how the cost of living adjustments and pay increases that have basically only brought them up to the 1995 level is not a decrease in their pay. Because of that, the American Bar Association has been working with many groups to lobby Capitol Hill for a much-needed pay increase in Congress. We obviously got very close this year. We didn't quite get the ball across the goal line. Hopefully, however, Alabama will in the Iron Bowl next weekend. But those are some of the threats that I see at both the state and the federal level to judicial independence. Thank you.
Judge Pryor, do you have any comments in response?
Well, there was a lot there. I have several disagreements. I don't think that I think, first of all, it is important for us to remember what we're talking about when we say judicial independence. Not everything that affects the quality or the best work of the judiciary is necessarily a threat to its independence. Independence is primarily defined as independence from the other branches of government. If you look at the Declaration, the focus of colonial Americans was on independence of judges from the king. If you look at the debate about judicial independence at the time of the founding, the concern was independence from the executive and from the legislative branches. It was tied
with the separation of powers. I don't think, though, that the independence was ever really ever conceived as independence from the people. And a lot of what I hear from Tommy and from others who are concerned about modern threats to judicial independence are really concerns about public accountability. It's true, elections can sometimes be ugly. I don't want to dispense with elections in the United States. We need elections does anyone want to dispense with elections for legislatives, for executives? I'm not saying that the only way to select judges is by election, but a great number of states have done so for a very long time. And it's based on the notion that the judiciary is not to be independent from the people themselves. By taking an oath to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States, which, you know, the Constitution begins, we the people, we are affirming our accountability to the will of the people. And if you look at the alternative models out there, particularly at the state level, a lot of the appointment processes are really controlled by another subterranean form of politics. And I totally agree with Tommy that you cannot take the politics out of judicial selection. But that can be an ugly form of politics as well, a lot of which is a bar-controlled form of politics. Now, I'm sorry. I think there's every bit as much or more of a threat to judicial independence when the major players in the process are the lawyers who are regularly practicing before the judges. And in many years, when there have been changes from non-competitive election systems to competitive election systems in the states, what you have witnessed is a change. Some states, it was a one-party control in the Deep South. There was a lot of that going on, or non-competitive elections in other parts of the country where really the only players who ever cared about judicial elections were lawyers. They were the major contributors, and things got out of hand, and there was a reaction. And then we got, you know, higher dollar, more competitive, and in some cases you can find examples of ugly, and everyone in here could agree, bad examples of threats to the judiciary. But in many cases, this was a pushback from a process where lawyer influence in judicial selection was viewed as corrupting and undermining of the quality and the independence of the judiciary. And I welcome the American Bar Association to any call for depoliticizing the profession and the judiciary. But I think it's worth, I think it, that is an important role for the American Bar Association to play. But frankly, I haven't been a member of the American Bar Association for a long time. And the reason is because for a long time, I have considered it to be far too political an organization. I think it's important for us to have an organization of American lawyers who defend judicial independence, who defend the importance of the rule of law, but I don't think that it is necessarily needed for that organization to have a position on just about every issue under the sun that comes before the Congress of the United States, to file, be a frequent filer of amicus briefs in the courts of the United States, and to take positions on issues that have literally nothing to do with the profession. I'm not accusing Tommy of having done that. I do think, though, that that has been a recurring problem of the ABA. And if the ABA wants to be an effective voice in strengthening the judiciary and its independence, and strengthening, in many cases, what I hear him talk about and what I hear bar leaders talk about is the quality of the judiciary, which we should all welcome, then I would say it's important to keep your own house in order and to look with some introspection and to consider what can we do ourselves to depoliticize and to be a more neutral and frankly effective voice in the debate.
Mr. Wells, I have a question that builds on that, and perhaps you could use your answer to respond both to me and to Judge Pryor. Unlike the Federalist Society, the ABA adopts legal policy positions and files amicus briefs. Indeed, it does so across a vast array of issues, and it routinely adopts liberal or hard left living constitutionalist positions. At the same time, the ABA Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary, often heavily stacked with members who have the same ideological attachments, has a privileged role in evaluating federal judicial nominees, and it has on occasions exercised that role in a blatantly partisan fashion. Does this set of ABA roles present a threat to your concept of judicial independence? Specifically, won't any sitting judge who hopes for promotion feel an undue pressure to comport his rulings with ABA positions?
Let me first direct this to Judge Pryor. Judge, I object to that question. It is leading, and it assumes numerous facts not supported by the evidence.
Overruled.
Was that an example of decisional independence? I'm going to try to respond to both, and I apologize if I don't hit everything in Ed's question, because it was, believe me, as a practicing lawyer who tries cases, I don't think I would allow a witness to answer a question quite that convoluted. First, let me say this. Again, Ed made some comments about liberal, left-leaning, you know, the ABA gets criticized from both sides, and I think when we do get criticized from both sides, we probably are doing some things right. There have been a lot of what people would consider quote-unquote conservative positions that the ABA has taken. When I was chair of the House of Delegates, we had a rather spirited debate on asbestos reform legislation and supported legislation in Congress to reform the asbestos mess that we have in litigation in the country. You know, there are a whole lot of things that the ABA takes positions on, but we try. We're not always successful because I think the issue of germaneness to the legal profession can be debated. We're not always successful in holding a clear line of germaneness. But at least since I've been involved in the American Bar Association, we have taken germaneness as a serious issue. This is nothing new. I happened to go research the American Bar Association to find the first president of the American Bar Association was from Alabama, happened to be a lawyer named Henry Upson Sims. Henry Upson Sims was president of the American Bar Association in 1929 and 1930. You may also not believe this, but his contribution to the stock market crash has been greatly exaggerated. But Henry Upson Sims presided over a debate at the American Bar Association at their meeting, their annual meeting. This was before we had a House of Delegates, where the central issue of debate was so controversial about whether or not it was a position that a bar association should take a position on that they literally decided to send it out to a vote of the entire membership of the association. Guess what that issue was? Prohibition. I think the argument could be made, is that germane to the practice of law? Maybe, maybe not. After all, we are the Bar Association. let me also take 1 second to explain how the American Bar Association adopts policies. We don't just get together a small group of like-minded folks and come up with policies out of whole cloth. We have a 555-member House of Delegates. I have invited and continue to invite the Federalist Society, and there are members of the Federalist Society who are in the House, to send delegates to our House of Delegates and join in the debate. It's very spirited. Probably 80% of the members of the ABA House of Delegates are selected by state and local bar associations. I don't know about your bar association, but mine is not exactly a hotbed of far-left ultra-liberalism. And yet, they are the ones, the Birmingham Bar Association, the Alabama State Bar governors are the ones who select the representatives who go and take up these issues and debate them and vote on them. So that's how we end up taking positions on issues. Some people say we're political. I think that's fair. I think this organization is political. I'm not sure that my office, my law firm, is political. We are political beings. Let me mention one aspect of the ABA that I think was in your question, Ed, and that's our Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary. Since President Eisenhower, the Standing Committee on Federal Judiciary has been doing peer reviews of nominees for federal judgeships. From the Eisenhower administration until the Bush administration, we were asked to do that by the White House in the pre-nomination context. The Bush White House decided to do the nominations first and have us do, and the Senate Judiciary Committee asked us to do our peer reviews later. These peer reviews are done on three criteria and three criteria only: professional competence, integrity, and judicial temperament. We don't rate ideology. We don't rate politics. We rate three items only.
But Tommy, excuse me, but we all know that judicial ideology, I'm sorry, Mr. Wells, has been smuggled into the judicial temperament criterion for some time. And we've seen that. I'm looking right now at what the ABA did to Mike Wallace. I mean, I've written extensively about this. It's an outrageous process culminating in perjury by the ABA, the chair of this ABA committee before the Senate Judiciary Committee. I've documented this. It's an ugly, ugly fact. And, I don't think to actually defend this at this point seems to me rather, rather difficult. And we have a lengthy discussion on the facts, but please respond, and then I'd like to see if we can get to a question before you.
I'll be glad to respond. First of all, under our setup for the Federal Judiciary Committee, you can't be involved in any ABA office. You can't be involved. You swear during the time you will be on the committee, you will not donate to any federal campaigns, and you will not participate in ABA politics. We have had people such as the current White House counsel, Fred Fielding, who sat on the committee. I met with Fred, along with Tom Sussman, several weeks ago, and Fred said he, quite frankly, he was skeptical about going on the committee when he went on it, and he said if I had seen a hint of anything, I would have resigned and made us think about it. And Fred, in discussions that we had just a few weeks ago, said he was perfectly satisfied that the committee, when he was sitting on the committee, was rating on professional competence, integrity, and judicial temperament. I can't comment on a specific nomination because I'm not privy to them. I don't see them. I'm the president of the ABA. I shouldn't see them. I shouldn't be privy to them. I have no input into it. I get to appoint. I got to appoint the chair. Kim Askew of Dallas, Texas, is going to chair the Federal Judiciary Committee this year, and I got to appoint a Fifth Circuit, a D.C. Circuit, and a Federal Circuit representative from that. I appointed David Clark from Jackson, Mississippi, to the Fifth Circuit, and Carolyn Williams from D.C. to the D.C. Circuit, and Joe Potenza from D.C. to the Federal Circuit. The Wallace issue, the only thing I can say about that, because believe me, I have not read and will not read the reports. All I can tell you is two different committees. Two different groups rated Mr. Wallace twice, and both rated him not qualified. I am confident that they did as good a job as human beings can do in that rating process.
Well, having actually written extensively on this and reviewed the report, I feel compelled here to note a few things. First of all, Kim Askew, who now is chair of this committee, was the person responsible for the review. It was replete with conflict of interest, including on her own part. Maybe she wasn't a member of some ABA bodies during those particular years, but she was on the Board of Trustees of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. John Payton, another member, was on the Board of People for the American Way. On the Board of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, he opposed President Bush's judicial nominees as well as nominees for Attorney General. In 2005, he decried the serious erosion of fundamental legal rights that we cherish and promote as Americans that had supposedly taken place since 9/11. Marna Tucker, another member, founding board member of the National Women's Law Center, long been activist within the ABA for feminist causes. Teresa Wynn Roseboro, former chairman and board member of the American Constitution Society. I can go on and on. I've documented this, and I think that if you look carefully at this, you know, there is a serious conflict. And I think the ABA, while claiming now to be promoting the cause of judicial independence, is seriously detracting from it. Now, we have just a minute to go, I think, so I'll take a quick question.
Second objection, Judge Bryan.
Now, this one's going to be sustained. The worst part, Ed, is I look at the mic, and there's a minute left, and Professor Graglia is going to be our first questioner.
Question. I wanted to say, proving that Mr. Whalen is correct, the ABA once said that I lack judicial temperament. And nobody ever agreed with that. I agree with what you said, Judge, except that to hear Marbury v. Madison described as an example of judicial restraint is extraordinary. It was totally political, like every constitutional decision since by the Supreme Court. That is, in that case, Chief Justice Marshall made up a statute that didn't exist. He says there's a statute that adds to the original jurisdiction. There wasn't.
And neither party argued that.
He did then that in order to find a constitutional objection, which also didn't exist. Right? The Constitution says you can't add the original, which it doesn't. He did all that simply so that he would not rule against Jefferson because you said it was not likely to be sustained. But a more thoroughly political decision than that, or thoroughly made up, I tell my students, my law students, model your career, ask yourself, would Marshall do it? That'll give you complete freedom.
I apologize, but I'm getting a signal that we need to release folks for lunch. So,
let the record reflect that I was defending Marbury versus Madison today.
Let me, Professor, just give you one brief comment. We actually, when I was chairing the House of Delegates in Seattle, we had a resolution that came up to commemorate the anniversary of Marbury versus Madison. You'll be glad to know 4% of the House voted no.
Thank you all.